Hi, nerds. I'm Michael Moore, hosting this podcast for Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm here with Alex Marzano, CIO at NextGen Power Systems. Hi, Alex. How you doing?
Wonderful, Michael. Pleasure to be with you.
Same here. We're going to jump right in. We're going to start with our icebreaker segment. It's called Random Access Memories. I ask a question, and then you respond with the answer that comes to your head first.
All right.
So your first question is, if you could travel to any IT-related location or destination, what would it be and why?
You know, I watched the movie Hidden Figures a couple of years back with the family. I'd love to be able to go back to that point in time. I mean, can you just imagine these empowered young ladies trying to get into information technology at its infancy and making that breakthrough?
It's such a powerful movie too. What a great movie! I could watch that one over and over again. That's a great spot, and what a way to kind of start that is just to get back to that spot. And they were doing math like they were doing math by hand.
Amazing things. Amazing.
I can't even do math by hand anymore. Right. All right. Well, what is the most fun or interesting IT-related hobby or activity that you have, or maybe you want to try?
You know, I love tinkering. I love upgrading. So my big passions are around building PCs, building little computers. I do a lot of this with my son, who's an avid PC gamer, and it's always fun to just to go out there and see what that next build might look like. Taking a look at that new GPU that's coming out and how we might be able to put it into some sort of a caseless computer, a gaming computer. So that's probably, yeah, I think that's probably my most fun.
I love that answer because when I was a kid, I used to. I used to do that with my father, right? And back in those days, they had the they actually had the computer fairs where you would go, you know, and you could scout out equipment there. You know, now you just order it online. But you know, anyone old enough will remember when you actually had to go to a fair and be able to get it.
Yeah, we're wandering through a Fry's Electronics. I mean, how many hours did we spend in those kind of places?
It's 100%. Yeah. I remember putting together like, hey, listen, you can get me a new computer or I can build one for half the cost and I know how to do it.
And right? Twice as good, right?
Yeah. Twice as good. Right. Exactly. Oh, that was good. Good. Too. This is a good one. What's the weirdest coping mechanism you have seen people do to combat IT related stress or frustration?
I had one individual that I used to work with on the team and he was just like super fit. I used to look at this guy and go, wow, that's just amazing. Look how fit they are. And it turns out that while we were doing those Zoom calls and having those awkward conversations and whatnot, they had their camera off, they were on the floor and they were doing pushups. So this kind of time he had one of those awkward conversations, he just, you know, jump on the ground and start doing pushups, sit-ups, you know, whatever. So that exercise was his coping mechanism while the rest of us were like, you know, wringing our hands and pulling out our hair and he was just getting more and more fit. So,
oh my gosh, that's great.
Yeah.
So push-ups, that's it. Well, and I love the fact just getting more fit, right? Like that's actually fantastic.
Yeah, no, as opposed to the rest of us that are, you know, just kind of more during COVID. I mean, we're all so sedentary and look, this guy's actually taking advantage and the rest of us were quite honestly just putting on a couple of pounds. So
no, that's great. That's the way to do it. I guess I got to change my routine now and start working out more while I work through my day.
Yep.
I'm going to put the computer on the floor at that point and just, you know, push up, mouse click, push up, keyboard.
There you go. There you go.
All right. Well, it's a pleasure to have you on, and it's really, really interesting because you kind of look, you know, with a ton of different experience here, you know, similar to me in this kind of over 20 years of IT experience and you know where it's taken us over the course and stuff like that of our career. You've got so many different interesting things. I'm looking at this too because PwC, right? Mm-hmm. You did IT M&A integrations leader, which we're going to talk about. There's got to be a lot of interesting things for that. And then a CIO over at Omium. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Right?
Green hydrogen.
Green hydrogen generation. That's really awesome. And then now CIO over at NextGen Power Systems. So give us if you can, a little overview of NextGen and what they do.
Sure. We're kind of in that renewable energy space, green energy. So we make a gallium arsenic nitride device or semiconductor. As you know, most semiconductors are silicon-based. Ours is GaN-based. So what does that mean? Runs on higher voltages, higher switching frequencies. We're targeting the EV market. Right now, they were working on a deal with General Motors to be the architecture of the platform for the next generation inverters in GM EV cars. Net-net, all that means is because it runs at a higher voltage, the cars can charge faster. So what's their big barrier to adoption for EVs is, how long does it take to charge? If you can cut that time in half or possibly even by two-thirds, it's certainly the way to go. So that's what NextGen does.
It's always the batteries, right, that are the limit on things. I mean, I got a phone over here, and the phone works great. And it's been like, I think it's been over 3 years now for this phone. And I don't want to replace it, but the battery lasts like, not even a quarter of the day, right?
I'm just
constantly being charged, right? And I know that I'm like, all right, it's on its outs, and you can't like replace the battery like usual. So because they've locked these phones down so tight. It's always the battery that's the limit to these things. Sure. And so that sounds, so it looks like now you're increasing that capability to charge quicker.
Yes, sir.
Does that harm the life of the battery?
It doesn't harm the life of the battery. The reality, the harsh reality is, as you alluded to in your example, is batteries always degrade over time. There's a finite number of charge cycles in a battery. So if you can charge it quicker and more efficiently, so that you can maybe go a little longer between charges and you're not topping off all the time, that actually extends the life of the battery. So it's really sort of a big plus.
Oh, so, that's awesome. Yes. Yeah. That's actually really cool. And that makes sense too. Because I know what I'm doing to my phone right now, plugging it in every 10 seconds is just making it worse. I'm going to need a new phone. I'm wrapping my head around that. How were Omium and NextGen? It seems like a very, very similar type concept.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They're sort of in the same place, that same, green energy, renewable energy space. And it's kind of interesting because, one of the things that at NextGen is we're making technology to charge electric cars quicker. But what Omium was doing is kind of taking maybe just a different stance on that renewable energy. So instead of these huge battery arrays, right now we're pushing very heavy for solar power, for wind power. But what happens when the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing? We store that energy in huge batteries. And let's be honest, there's nothing in a battery that's good for you. Nobody wants to eat, next to a battery. You don't want to have anything spilling out of a battery into your, yard or garage. However, with hydrogen, what you can now do is take that solar power, take that wind power, use that DC power directly to power one of Omium's hydrogen electrolyzers, and on one side, they're pouring water in, and out the other side, you get hydrogen, oxygen, and water. So there's nothing that comes out of that electrolyzer that anyone's really worried about. I mean, nobody minds having a little water spill on the ground or a little bit more oxygen go out into the air. And then you can store that hydrogen so that when the sun isn't shining or the wind's not blowing, you use the hydrogen to create electricity. And in that process where you're burning hydrogen, again, your only byproducts are water, oxygen, and maybe a little hydrogen.
Wow. What a that's it. That sounds like a really good that sounds really good for the environment, right? Also the ability to reuse some of that while you're doing that is fantastic.
At Dissecting Popular IT Nerds, we expect to win, and we expect our IT directors to win. And one of those areas where we know that we can help you win is internet service providers. As an IT director tasked with managing internet connectivity, few vendor relationships can prove more painfully frustrating than the one with your internet service provider. The array of challenges seems never-ending, from unreliable uptime and insufficient bandwidth to poor customer service and hidden fees. It's like getting stuck in rush hour traffic. Dealing with ISPs can try one's patience even on the best of days. So whether you are managing one location or 100 locations, our back office support team and vendor partners are the best in the industry. And the best part about this is none of this will ever cost you a dime due to the partnership and the sponsors that we have behind the scenes at Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. Let us show you how we can manage away the mediocrity and hit it out of the park. We start by mapping all of the available fiber routes, and we use our 1.2 billion in combined customer buying power and massive economy of scale to map all of your locations, to overcome construction fees, to use industry historical data, to encourage providers to compete for the lowest possible pricing, to negotiate the lowest rates guaranteed, and to provide fast response times in hours, not days. And we leverage aggregators and wholesale relationships to ensure you get the best possible pricing available in the marketplace. And on top of all of this, you get proactive network monitoring and proactive alerts so that you're not left calling 1-800-GO-POUND-SAND to enter in a ticket number and wonder, why is my internet connection down? In short, we are the partner that you have always wanted, who understands your needs, your frustrations, and knows what you need without you having to ask. So we're still human, but we are some of the best, and we aim to win. This all starts with a value discovery call where we find out what you have, why you have it, and what's on your roadmap. All you need to do is email internet@popularit.net and say, I want help managing all of my internet garbage. Please make my life easier, and we'll get right on it for you. Have a wonderful day.
It's funny, looking at your volunteering too. This kind of tracks with your volunteering as well, right? I volunteer at the over here. It's Make Your City Beautiful. They enter in whatever your city is, right? Nice. And so we go pick up, garbage at parks and stuff like that. What I see here is a couple things, right? So you've got adventure guides, naturalist guides, right? And then you got a leader at the Boy Scouts of America.
Yes, yes. Actually, big into scouting. I mean, since I was a kid, I was big into scouting, and then had the opportunity to run through that with my son. Adventure guides is actually a program that's sponsored by the YMCA. And they have numerous father-son and father-daughter groups. So, if anyone's out there thinking about what they're going to do with their son and daughter, I highly recommend these programs. You know, go out, spend the time, engage with your kids. Usually it's a once a week kind of deal. We have some sort of an art or a craft. And then maybe once a month we go and have a little camping trip. When I was promoting adventure guides, one of the big pitches, you would think that you would be talking to the dads, but really I went and talked to the moms, and the pitch was something along the lines of this: how would you like to have your husband and the kids out of the house at least once a week and go on at least one weekend a month so you can have the whole house by yourself? And lo and behold, pretty much every dad got signed up. So
yeah, that was they're all side-eyeing you going, really? No.
Worked out well.
No, that's great. Actually, that's a very good, and it's great too, because you're getting them out of the house, you're getting them into nature. They get that appreciation of it up front, and it just tracks so well with what you're doing too. When you're lined up with work.
Yeah.
This is great. I'm a big proponent of this, because it's this is some of the items that we really need to be looking at moving forward, using technology, right, to push forward stuff that's going to help our environment, right? That makes complete sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, when we look at these technologies, we have to, I always kid with some of my colleagues, and I go, look, there's two ways to do this. You know, we can do things like stop using plastic bags. Okay. Yes, absolutely. Plastic bags are the bane of our landfills, and we certainly should move away from them. But one approach is to outlaw them. And then you end up walking out of the grocery store carrying, you know, a can of beans and a can of corn and your hamburger meat. The other is, why not go to technology? You know, we have biodegradable bags. The technology is out there.
Exactly.
So rather than outlaw something, why don't we just replace it with something that is a little bit more eco-friendly?
Let's make the technology work for us. I mean, that's what we do for a living anyway, right? So let's make the technology work for us and actually improve it. I love it. I love that, and not fight
these adoption issues, right? So I think often we try to find things out there, and then there's this big battle for adoption. But if we just think a little bit smarter about that technology, we can kind of, you know, close a lot of those barriers. Even with EVs right now, the big concern is charging and range. So if we just kind of focus a little bit more on the technology, I think a lot of those barriers go away, and we end up with a better environment.
I love when my guests actually do the transition for me, and I really appreciate you transitioning us to business process systems transformation, right? Because we can talk about getting rid of barriers to adoption right there.
Sure. Sure. So, no, absolutely.
So, no, I appreciate, what a great transition. Let's talk about business process systems transformation, because we all know that one of the biggest issues that we have in this is adoption, is getting people to get on board and getting that transformation kicking. Let's talk about your experience on this.
Sure. I'll call out one experience in particular. I worked for a company, Cisco Systems, here in the Bay Area. We had a leader there, Rebecca Jacoby, the COO, just an amazing woman. And I just learned so much working for her. And one of the lessons that we learned is these business processes. Actually, several things about them. So number one is we went through and transformed all of our primary processes, quote to cash, procure to pay, incent to resolution. And then when we went through that whole process, we immediately started back at the beginning again. Because what we found is by the time you got through that cycle, you've either introduced new products, you've entered new markets, your customers' requirements have changed. So take a look at those opportunities to streamline, make sure you're meeting demand. Is it something that you're, you know, currently doing in three steps that we can do in two steps? Is it something where the customer has to jump through an extra hoop in order to get what they're looking for? Or can we do something in the process to better define it and make it a little bit more streamlined? So that's something that she really pushed. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to learn that lesson. May not have seemed like a lesson at the time and was more a lot of work, but it's something that, you know, later I've been able to take away and say, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The other thing that she did that I thought was just so amazing, and I've taken it to heart, and this is what I do today, is that we blur the lines between IT and the business. A lot of times, you know, you go into a meeting and the business comes and they have a requirement, and you can see on one side of the room, you've got the business people saying, here's what we do, and this is the way the process should look. And then you look at the other side of the table and you've got a Java programmer, a Python programmer, a C++ guy, and you know, they're talking bits and bytes and release this and release that. But what we really need to do to be better partners is you really need the business person on both sides of the table. That person in IT should understand what the business is doing as well, possibly even better than the business does. And I think that's something that I kind of promote as sort of that modern CIO or modern IT role, is that we really speak the business in business terms. We are a true business partner. When we go into a conversation, it's not about, hey, we need a new CRM system. It's more, what is it that you're expecting? What are our goals for this system? What specifically does this process look like? What are the steps? Map it all out. How do we measure success? And actually put those tools in place to measure and monitor so that once we go live, if we see that we're not getting the results that we want, we're flexible enough to change and switch gears.
I think it's accurate. And, you know, the amount of people that I've had come into my office sometimes, you know, and say, hey, I want to do this and start talking tech. And I've just said, stop, hold on a second. Right. How about you just tell me what your current process is and why it's not working? Right. Let's just start there and see if we can fix the process and then see how technology folds on top of that afterwards.
Yeah. And then, Michael, you know, one thing that we really have an advantage in IT is that when you work in any modern organization, you know, what you start to notice is that, unfortunately, there are silos. The finance person doesn't really know what the marketing team is thinking, or the sales team, or the engineering team, or the manufacturing team. But what they do all have in common are the IT teams. So we have a view of the business, and I like to promote it as a connected view of the business. We can see what the initiatives are, the pain points, when resources are available for different groups. And as opposed to, you know, back in the day where the business would come with some initiative, we're actually in a position to propose when's the best time to implement that new CRM. You know, quarter three, it looks like, you know, this guy's going to be doing this and that guy's going to, you know, that group's going to have that available. That's when we should do this and make those proposals. So it's kind of a little bit of a different paradigm. You know, a lot of IT groups want to measure themselves on, you know, how long did it take me to close out that trouble ticket or this or that, which of course is all important. But I think in our new business climate and atmosphere, IT CIOs and especially CIOs, they need to be able to drive initiatives that directly impact that bottom line and kind of take IT from that G&A cost center into perhaps a revenue generating or at least assisting in revenue generation for the enterprise.
It's interesting because, you know, IT, as you know, IT formed out from the financial part of the business, right? So I always thought that was integral to doing this. Before I was telling you kind of before we got started here that I was on this podcast before I was hosting the podcast, right, as a co-host. One of the things I did was talking about making IT not the cost center, right? Hey, IT isn't a cost center. It shouldn't be viewed as that, all right? But it's an enabler of, I mean, you can use IT, leverage IT, not just for strategic reasons, but you can really understand the business and do that cost reduction. If you want, IT knows a lot about where all the costs are being, where the cost can be reduced significantly.
Right. No, absolutely. And then, you know, we take our roadmaps, you know, and I remember sitting with a large payment company talking to their CFO and he was kind of complaining, look, you know, the IT budget for this company is $25 million a year or something like that. And look, there's four reports that I've been trying to get for whenever or however long. And now I have to go out and, you know, farm this out to someone else. And I don't know what the heck IT is delivering. And when I went back to the CIO and said, guys, look at our roadmap. It says release this, upgrade to version that. Nothing on this roadmap ties back to a business capability, a business competitive advantage, a business goal or initiative. And everything we do should tie back to one of those three things.
Yep.
Give the CFO that transparency. This is what you're paying for. This is what IT is delivering for the organization.
Yeah, no, agreed. I think that's a huge piece to it. And I think sometimes, you know, when you talk about the silos that you had mentioned, the problem with the silos is that sometimes they create their own views of importance of what things are important versus other things. And so we do end up with these silos of people that think they're doing the right thing, but are not doing what they're supposed to be doing, as opposed to what the executive team is leading them towards. And so you can run that risk. Also, If we want to talk about silos, let's talk about M&A integration a bit, right? Because M&A integration creates some of the biggest silos that can happen.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think some of that some of those silos happens through just people not being transparent as to what's the goal of this transaction. Why are we acquiring this company? Is this an IP play? Are we trying to integrate their product into our product line? Are we trying to keep them as a Halo performer, a Halo product, and run unique? So when I was at Cisco, I worked on their first 13 acquisitions from number one, Crescendo, I think all the way through. It was either Stratacom or Granite Bay. I'm not sure exactly which one was the last one. And you know, not all of them were out of the ballpark. I mean, Crescendo was an amazing acquisition for Cisco, Stratacom, of course. But we had some weird ones. Like we did a flip camera. So I don't know if anyone remembers what the flip camera is, but it's literally a little digital camera.
I remember it.
Yeah, and Cisco bought them, and at the time I was thinking, why? Well, is there a network card in here? Is it wireless? I didn't really get it, but I think you know those are cases where we need to be very clear as to what's the goal of the acquisition, and then let people know. One of my greatest joys in doing M&A was working with people who had just been acquired, and you can see the whole cycle, you know, when they're in jubilation, and then, you know, a month later, maybe they're down in the depths of despair. Oh my gosh, you know, I didn't sign up to work for this company. I really wanted that environment. Now everything's going to be different. And then finally you can see them coming back up and thinking, wow, look, this is opening up huge new opportunities. So. Yeah. So great, great time, you know, great excitement. I'll tell you, I just very briefly, I worked for an M&A not that long ago with PwC for a large hospitality company back in the East Coast. And I won't name the name of the company, but I worked with this individual, and his name was Michael Hilton. let me tell you, I'm sorry, you probably don't know who he is. That's Paris's uncle.
Oh gosh.
but it was just like, oh my gosh, you know, this is you're going into meetings, and there's an individual that's in that meeting every day, you know, asking the hard questions about you know, an FP&A software or an M&A transaction or some integration issue. And yeah, it's just an amazing time, an amazing company. So they just give them a little
you know what? It's interesting, but it does happen, and it's amazing to see sometimes where you're like, oh well, hey, they're understanding the business. I personally think that's one of the best things is when you see somebody whose maybe core work is not IT, but they understand the value of understanding the technical pieces of it to a degree of how it affects their business. That's a huge deal, and you can really see the maturity level of the business person by measuring how much they want to understand how that tech affects them, or how that process that technical affects their process, and or know how you can make it better. You know, it's a really interesting. The M&As were cool because you go in and do your due diligence up front, which is just a massive data gathering of everything that's going on. And then you sit down and go, okay, first of all, if I don't even integrate it, what are the problems that I have right off the bat? You know, let's look at compliance. Let's look at all these things that are going to be just an issue in general. And then you say, okay, now if I was going to go and implement it, you know, how would I do it in my dream of implementation, right? And then you go, okay, now that I have the dream, now let's look at the requirements. Oh, they want a 0-day cutover. Okay. That's all right. Oh, we're going to, you know, we're not going to keep this part of the business, but we're going to keep this one. So I'm not going to get that equipment. I'm going to get this equipment. You know, I'm not going to get the budget that I want. So I have to, skimp in some areas. Lots of different challenges there, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, as long as we define those goals up front, and like you say, is it 0 days or whatever at Cisco, we had a goal of 30 days. So 30 days after deal close, we're fulfilling product through Cisco's order entry systems.
Still pretty aggressive.
very aggressive, and usually we even beat that by some amount of time. Now, it doesn't mean it was all pretty on the back end, but nonetheless, you know, it was happening. And usually the goals for a lot of these M&A transactions are, you know, the company's got a great product, but look, it's a little company, you know, and now you have a big company. So whereas they're buying in quantities of, you know, maybe thousands, you're buying in quantities of hundreds of thousands. And how do we bring those economies of scale to bear, you know, bring that product into our manufacturing infrastructure and, you know, build it for less and sell a gazillion more to our sales force. So we have to move quickly. It's got to happen rapidly, but you need to make these decisions up front.
Yeah, I'm glad you actually brought that up because, you know, they create these profiles and they know and have the amount that they're going to hit these financials, right? So they know. So they're relying on the IT department for a lot of this to be able to hit these goals and these numbers. So it makes sense. And it's, you know, during an M&A, it's extremely stressful, but it pulling one off is like the best feeling in IT, you know, like, I mean, it actually getting it done and hitting all the milestones and the business turning around and being like, thank you, is a great uplift for the entire team.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow, that's fantastic. It's exciting work. It's grueling, but exciting work in M&A. It really is. Did you ever get into the legal portions of it and have to work with the legal team?
No, absolutely. Yeah. We started from doing the due diligence all the way through the final cutovers, terminating agreements, terminating leases, moving people out of buildings, getting a staff integrated into the new company, into new roles. Yeah. So the full gamut.
It is a lot. It is a lot. But I tell you, if you get good at, and this is for our audience, if you get good at M&A integration, there's nothing you can't implement going forward.
Yeah, no, Michael, it's so true because you really have to understand the organization and the business functions and you know, not just a cursory understanding, but and of course this is where IT has the benefit is that, you know, we do understand these processes down to the nuts and bolts.
Yep, that's actually right. And you know, you have to understand not only your business, but the new business that you're looking at. And be able to quickly understand what's happening there and how it'll affect the processes that go forward. M&A is such a great training tool for regular business integrations and stuff and systems that that will occur naturally. So that was actually some amazing skill set and you picked up through that process.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah. So, and I can't imagine now I did that. Cybersecurity wasn't, it was still big, but it wasn't anywhere near it is what it is now. Especially compliance was big. Mine was in healthcare. So compliance was a massive in that. And then later on I had a parent from over in Europe. So, additional compliance on top of compliance. Right. So, But cybersecurity in that was big back then, but now it's such huge and prevalent. And with everything that's going on, I can't imagine trying to do M&A integration or business process systems transformation with also making sure you're putting in that cybersecurity as well, if it's not already there to begin with.
Yeah, so let me put my CISO hat on. We don't have a dedicated CISO, so I'm responsible. But cyber is really the thing that keeps me up, I guess, the most at night out of all of these problems. You know, it's really cybersecurity. And I kind of break the threats into two categories. So one is IP related. So anything that drains our intellectual property, whether it be a foreign actor or a competitor, I mean, these are door shuttering events, right? So that's that's got to be number one. It's paramount. Everything that we do, it's got to have that protect our IP focus.
Yep.
The second part of it is more financial implications. So either, you know, a loss to the company, someone spoofing an invoice, or maybe, you know, somebody's committing fraud against one of our employees or one of our customers. So again, very important, but you know, you can always try to make more money. Very difficult to make more IP. So I kind of break it into those two categories. And I think in thinking about it that way, the thing that we also have to consider is that, a cyber event or a cyber breach, it's a when. It's not an if. It is going to happen. It doesn't, I go to a lot of security conferences. I listen to a lot of vendors with the shiny new tool. It doesn't matter if you buy every tool that's out there. Whether you spend $1 million, $10 million, $100 million, something is going to happen, right?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
So I think I take a little bit of a different approach on some of the financial implications. I of course we do all the basics. You know, everything. All we have endpoint security. We've got multi-factor authentication, single sign-on, firewalls. Various antivirus. We do all of those things, but where we really focus on is the response. So when something happens, do I have my backups? Do I have my, 3-2-1, three copies, two medias, or three medias, one immutable?
Yep.
Do I have it? Can I recover from a ransomware, which we see constantly? You know, and the answer is yes. Do I rehearse it? Do we actually try to recover from that backup? Do we have our response policies that define, do we have third-party console? Do I have them on our speed dial? Do we have our cyber insurance carrier on speed dial? Do I have a third-party IT forensic team that's going to come in and look at what happened and make a determination what the issue is? Because I don't want my people doing it, because I don't want any hint that maybe there was someone involved. So we bring in third parties to say, yeah, here's what happened. So I think from that standpoint, a lot of us, we really need to look at that response. And then finally, when I was at Cisco, I was in the security engineering group. And one of the things that we kind of concluded was something like 85%+ of breaches was just a phishing attempt. Somebody using a password that they'd been using on Facebook for the last 20 years or something like that. So we also focus very heavily on awareness and training. And I distinguish the two. I was recently at a CISO talk, and people were talking about training and education. And I go, yeah. When you go to these various enterprise companies, once a year or possibly twice a year, you'll get a little training requirement that says, you need to go through this and make sure you change your passwords and don't do this and watch out for phishing and whatever. But that, and what I was trying to stress with those folks is that that's training. That's not awareness. Awareness is something you do instinctively. When I get that email, I think twice before I click on it. When I see that question, I think twice. That is awareness. You can't do that once a year or twice a year.
That's
you have to reinforce it constantly.
You're 100% accurate. And, it's funny. Let's go back to what you said about the compliance piece, because what ends up happening, and the running joke, I think, in the compliance of anyone that does compliance, right, is that, listen, yeah, I wrote it all down. It's on my, I can have an auditor walk in here. They'll read it all. It all looks pretty. I can show them the evidence. Here you go. Move on. All right. Go on. Great. That you can pass an audit, right? But can you pass an attack, right? That's a whole other ball game, right? I mean, an audit's just going to tell you that you're doing everything the way you should be doing it, by the books, right? But I love what you're talking about actually testing it and doing the response and stuff like that. That's the piece that really matters. Because that's what's going to happen when you're ready to go. And I was at a different company and leading their security and privacy program. And I said to them, I said, hey, listen, I need people from the business, and you can select who you want, but we're going to do a walkthrough, right? And we're doing a scenario walkthrough. And okay, what would you do now? What would you do now? They got done. And I think the response from one of the executives was, well, thank you, Michael. I'm not going to sleep tonight. I'm like, then I did my job. that I did my job, right? So that was the whole point. I'm like, yeah, you need to think about these things, right? And not all of them are IT. A lot of them are people, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's, you know, recently I was at a company, and actually somebody from another company, maybe a sister company, was calling, and they had an event, and they asked about it. And, you know, it's like, well, we need a single sign-on, we need multi-factor, and da, da, da. And I said, no, guys, you know, here's fundamentally what happened. An email was sent to your accounting group. Your accounting group paid that invoice that was attached to that email. Okay. Yes, that email got to you because of an IT issue. And if we did these things, you know, that would take care of it. But fundamentally, look at our business process. We paid an invoice that did not have a PO associated with it. There was no confirmation of any receipt of the goods and services associated with that invoice. And it got paid. And it was not a trivial amount. This was not a one or two or three or $10,000 kind of thing. It was hundreds of thousands of dollars. How does that happen? So business processes, we have to go back to those fundamentals. Those controls have to be in place. And, you know, I the analogy I gave him, I said, hey, what if I sent that invoice in?
Well, that's why you, and this is great, because that's why now you're starting to see things like, oh, you have to have a wire transfer policy. Oh, you have to have they have these policies now that are more business oriented and business related, not just technical, right? And you're 100% right. You got to have the technical pieces. You got to have all those items. But more importantly, you know, you need to have the business related processes put in there to make sure.
And that goes back to that awareness. You know, when you get that invoice, you should be questioning it just off the bat. You know what? How do I know this is really legit? Right. So that's the awareness piece that, you know, we have to drive. And awareness doesn't always mean passwords and, you know, logins. Right. So sometimes it just means business acumen. And does that really make sense? Do I really think the CEO just called me and asked me to send him some gift cards? You know, I need to think down to that level and, you know, question every one of those interactions,
especially because of the now that we're in. How well some technologies are mimicking, are mimicking things and people and stuff like that, and it's just going to get even more. Already right now, you know, it's hard to detect. And can you imagine what the future will hold with that?
At Dissecting Popular IT Nerds, we expect to win, and we expect our IT directors to win. And one of those areas where we know that we can help you win is internet service providers. As an IT director tasked with managing internet connectivity, few vendor relationships can prove more painfully frustrating than the one with your internet service provider. The array of challenges seems never ending, from unreliable uptime and insufficient bandwidth to poor customer service and hidden fees. It's like getting stuck in rush hour traffic. Dealing with ISPs can try one's patience even on the best of days. So whether you are managing one location or 100 locations, our back office support team and vendor partners are the best in the industry. And the best part about this is none of this will ever cost you a dime due to the partnership and the sponsors that we have behind the scenes at Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. Let us show you how we can manage away the mediocrity and hit it out of the park. We start by mapping all of the available fiber routes, and we use our $1.2 billion in combined customer buying power and massive economy of scale to map all of your locations, to overcome construction fees, to use industry historical data, to encourage providers to compete for the lowest possible pricing, to negotiate the lowest rates guaranteed, and to provide fast response times in hours, not days. And we leverage aggregators and wholesale relationships to ensure you get the best possible pricing available in the marketplace. And on top of all of this, you get proactive network monitoring and proactive alerts so that you're not left calling 1-800-GO-POUND-SAND to enter in a ticket number and wonder, why is my internet connection down? In short, we are the partner that you have always wanted, who understands your needs, your frustrations, and knows what you need without you having to ask. So We're still human, but we are some of the best, and we aim to win. This all starts with a value discovery call where we find out what you have, why you have it, and what's on your roadmap. All you need to do is email internet@popularit.net and say, I want help managing all of my internet garbage. Please make my life easier, and we'll get right on it for you. Have a wonderful day.
I'd like to, if we can, jump into our IT crystal ball segment, where I go over, basically, I ask you about the future of IT in this spot. AI always comes up in this, but AI is the now. Like, that's not future, right? The question really with AI and other pieces is, what will that look like 5 to 10 years out, right? You know, go 5 years out, what is AI going to be doing? That's the question that nobody can seem to put their finger on, right?
Yeah.
We all know that AI is the thing, right? We all know that, it's going to be something big, but we don't know where it's leading us. And there's lots of questions and lots of pieces there. When I first started doing this crystal ball, it was always AI. That was the answer. Now what we need to start thinking is, what will AI be doing to M&A? What will AI be doing to business process systems transformation? What will AI be doing with the role of the CIO? What will AI be doing with cybersecurity? That's where I think this next thought process needs to head. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, absolutely. But so let's level set and let's talk about what AI is doing to us today, right? So today in the current, whereas before I'm dealing with nefarious actors and, rogue states, in handfuls or maybe thousands or tens of thousands, now we're dealing with AI deep fakes in hundreds or millions, right? It's nothing for them to generate these. So how are we going to combat from a cybersecurity standpoint all of these potential breaches and incursions? And then that's where we have to go and start looking at the new tools out there to filter through these threats and figure out, what's valid, what's not valid. Everyone's going to get alert fatigue if we're having to filter through millions of threats. So, sure. So that's something today. We're dealing with it today. And I think, maybe it's not 5 years. It's probably more like 5 months that I'm certain that we're going to start, at least in enterprise, seeing more voicemails and possibly even videos or Zoom calls or presentations where it's like, no, that's not really that person.
And this is really me, by the way. I'm really on this side. This is actually, it's not an AI. I'm actually me.
I'm going to check your blockchain credentials afterwards to make sure that this has been authenticated. But that is really going to be kind of a scary time for us. And I think we're sort of in it right now. But if we were to fast forward for 5 years or 2 years or whatnot, I see huge benefits from the incorporation of AI. AI is great at aggregating and consolidating and drawing conclusions. But where it really, and this kind of goes back to our cyber, maybe some CISO roles. Again, I was at a panel and, we were talking about data and, data security, and all the CISOs were talking, we're going to put it in this folder and only these people can get there. And you only can get there if you have this security clearance and da, da, da. I said, no. You see, AI is going to change the way we look at data and certainly change the way I think the CISO looks at data. Whereas before, we're only concerned with protecting data or hiding it or keeping it secure or not letting access. Now, that data, that's what trains our AI. We're feeding our AI that data. And we need to be aware of what data we're feeding AI, what biases that data contains. If we were to look at conflict in the Middle East and we look on the web here in the United States, it gives us one picture of that conflict. If we were to go in the Middle East and look at that on the web over there, it gives us a different picture. So we need to understand the bias that data presents. And when we consume this data and we this data is basically the textbooks that we're using to educate our AI. We need to include that. Is it regional? Is it cultural? Is it, gender? Is it whatever it happens to be? We now need to ensure that those attributes are taken into account. And when we feed the AI, we understand what it's directed at. And we may want to use one set of data for this group and another set of data for a different group. And that I think that's going to be a challenge for us because it's not something that we're used to thinking about. We all have a mindset that, well, you know, if I read it here, of course it's right. And you know, it's no longer about being right. It's more about your context and your perspective. And I think we're going to have to start realizing that with the data. And it's going to be an interesting time. It's certainly going to be an interesting time teaching AI.
It's such an interesting perspective to take on that. And especially since if you start to think about right now, most people, right, are using Microsoft's AI or they're using Google's AI, right? And that is just a giant, a giant model that's been fed a ton of data. And yes, it's got more data than a model that you would have sitting here, you know, running out of your house, right?
But it's being fed a ton of data from the internet.
And
this is going to be a shocker. Yeah. Not everything on the internet is true.
Exactly. How many times have you asked a question, gotten back data, and then been like, "That's not right. That's not accurate."
Yeah. And you know, it's not a bunch of, you know, Boolean logic, you know, and if thens. These are black boxes. So we be really careful about what we feed it and truly understand in order to understand what the conclusions it starts to draw from this data, you know, happen to be.
Absolutely, when taking your thought process about having different viewpoints, having different even ideologies and stuff like that, feeding into it makes a difference. And then the question is how are they going to allocate for that? Having one big model. I mean, maybe their models need to change, and they need to start segmenting out the models a bit. To be able to do that. And, you know, it actually changes to a degree because, you know, even with Microsoft's Copilot, right? So tons of people have been asking for it, and I've said, hold on a second. Remember, it's going to take all your data, and then it's going to allow everyone else to see that data. And so if you don't have like valid permissions on your data, right? And then you turn around and you just say, yeah, let's do that. Payroll data could be handed out to the rest of the team and all this stuff. It's scary. And then, you know, yeah, does it keep it segmented towards your business? I mean, we think so, right? We hope Microsoft is doing that. But what we know, from previous things is not just Microsoft and Google and stuff like that. They do their best, but they're not always 100% accurate on that. So if you're feeding company data into that, there's a chance that data could be leaking out into the bigger model and then you could have issues. So then the question is, if you're only using your model that you're sitting there working with, right? How much are you slanting and skewing that model?
And I think, you know, you're absolutely right. So Microsoft, you know, I mean, our big concern, especially if something IP related, is where's the data stored? How's the data shared? You know, we're very, very hesitant to, I shouldn't say very hesitant. I should say we just don't. We don't put anything IP related into any of the AIs that are out there, whether they're private LLMs or, you know, public LLMs. But there's huge opportunities for things that are driven more towards customer satisfaction or, say sales, marketing, trying to analyze, you know, the hits to our website or something like that. You know, huge opportunities, trying to get a customer to the right person to answer a question, right? Huge hits to productivity and customer satisfaction. That can all be done. You know, that's all out there. I will say, you know, to Microsoft's credit, you know, they're doing a lot of work and offering some of these, you know, as an Azure service, AI as an Azure service. And I think they are addressing some of that. Where's the data stored and how's it shared? So I think there's some great things around the corner and starting to answer some of these infancy concerns that we have. And, you know, hopefully in the next year or 2 years, you know, we'll start seeing the benefits. But
absolutely.
But then, and then the last thing on the data, you know, that I kind of harp on is that when we look at an organization or a company, you know, and they say, well, where's your data archived? And they show you all of this data, right? So now the other element that we have to start considering with AI is that data has an expiration. Yeah. So whereas we think everything is forever, right? So maybe this data is only good for the next 6 months or a year or 2 years or till the next product. And now, again, there's all of these attributes that we now need to assign to this data that we don't have that mindset before. Like I said, the CISO, their mindset is I need to protect it and govern, you know, and make sure it's secure. But we really need to now go back to our data governance policies. So every set of data that I have, I need to know who owns it. And then I need to make them responsible for all of these other attributes. So it's going to be a very challenging time. And I think that role belongs to the CISOs and making sure that it's enforced. And I think that's going to be a kind of a big paradigm shift. So we'll see how that plays out.
I love it. The future, what I got from this is the future of AI here is messy. It's just messy, and it needs people to help kind of throw standards around it, right? And that's kind of where the role of the CIO to help spearhead that for the organization, because we understand the business process, right? And we're able to take that messy, right, and make sense of it for each individual business that we're working for.
Yes, or at least bring some controlled chaos to it. So
controlled chaos. I like that better. Nerds, I'm Michael Moore. I've been hosting this podcast for Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I've been here with Alex Marzano, CIO at Next Gen Power Systems. Thank you so much, Alex. I appreciate you jumping on the podcast.
Michael, thank you so much for a wonderful conversation.
Absolutely.